WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you so much for joining us today. Since the arrival of Tidying Up with Marie Kondo, people have been asking Kondo's catchphrase about their possessions. Does it spark joy? Well, here's another question. Does that apply to our digital lives as well? My next guest says all those hours spent binging Marie Kondo on Netflix or liking cat videos or gramming your dinner last night, will they amount to a certain type of clutter too? And he proposes some solutions. Georgetown professor of computer science, Cal Newport, is the author of Digital Minimalism, Choosing a Focused Life in a Noisy World. In the book, he defines digital minimalism as a, quote, philosophy of technology use in which you focus your online time on a small number of carefully selected and optimized activities that strongly support the things you value and then happily miss out on everything else. And it all begins with something he calls a digital declutter. It's another installment of our Ask an Expert series, and Cal joins us now to explain how to become a digital minimalist in a world super saturated with tech. Professor Newport, welcome to All of It.
Hi, Allison. Thanks for having me on.
And listeners, if you would like to join in, our number is 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. If you have a question for the professor on how to declutter your life, your digital life, or if maybe you have a hack of your own you'd want to share, 212-433-9692. So, Professor, you approach digital minimalism as a philosophy. Why is it important to think of it that way rather than a list of tips and tricks?
Well, the tips and tricks don't seem to be working. This is what I observed when I was out there trying to take the temperature of why people seemed increasingly uneasy. And what they had discovered is that just trying to turn off their notifications or maybe take a digital Shabbat or not bring the phone into the bedroom or whatever the myriad number of common tips are wasn't getting the job done. They needed something stronger to resist these strong technological and cultural forces that are pulling their eyes back to these screens.
Well, what kind of technologies are we talking about? I mean, we know Facebook and Twitter, obviously, but does email fall into this? Video games?
Well, I'm focusing primarily on technology in people's personal life. So unfortunately, I can't give you an excuse not to answer your boss's email, but certainly social media, online news consumption, video games, streaming media, anything that's drawing your attention to a screen in your life outside of work.
So this sort of book is often written by a sociologist or someone who specializes in the human condition, but you're a professor of computer science. So how does that influence your perspective on tech?
Well, I think we have a long tradition of having technologists be involved in social criticism on technology. I mean, who better to give an interesting perspective than those of us who actually make a living thinking about these tools? So that's what I think about in my own life is I'm a technologist. I'm an academic computer scientist. I research these topics. But I'm also interested in the impact of these tools on people's lives.
One of the things I think is difficult about this for a lot of people is there's a social aspect to this. We're sort of wired to want approval, to want people to see our pictures, our posts, our tweet. And technology folks, they know this and they exploit this. How do you fight the natural instinct to want to be socially accepted?
Well, one of the things I found interesting when observing people who went through the digital declutter process that I recommend in the book is that of those who came back to social media after the process was over, almost all of them took it off their phone. And that actually cured about 99% of the excessive or compulsive use issues. That what's drawing us back to this screen is not so much that what we're seeing is so valuable that we can't stay away. It's more of these small hooks that are actually engineered into the apps that make them hard to resist. And once you take it off of the phone and something you access on a browser on your computer, you maintain the deep value you might still get out of it, but you sidestep a lot of the compulsive, addictive components.
Let's talk about that digital declutter. You said it's the first step. How does it work?
So you start from scratch. It's sort of emptying the proverbial closet of all of the clothes as opposed to just trying to take things out and look at them occasionally or one at a time. So I tell people to actually step away from all optional technologies in their personal life. So things that they can take a break from without it causing immediate problems, to do this for 30 days. And this is not just about a detox. I mean, you will get a detox effect, but it's also a time to reflect and figure out, what am I really about? What do I actually care about? What do I want to spend my time on in my life outside of work? And then when the 30 days are over, you assume that you're starting from a blank slate. And so before you'll add anything back into your life, it has to pass a pretty high threshold of, is this the best way to use technology to support one of these things I value? And if it is, what are my rules for maximizing the value I get out of it without having too much cost?
If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. If you have any questions for Georgetown professor Cal Newport, we're talking about decluttering our online lives. So one of the things I think is interesting, a word you use in your book to describe this digital decluttering, you call it an aggressive move. Why do you say that? And you also say you need to do it rapidly.
This is what seems to work. We've tried the slower things. You know, we've tried, let me change one setting, or let me have some good intentions, or let me set a New Year's resolution, and this just wasn't working for people. But having a much more aggressive, sudden change actually seemed to get results. It's very similar to diet and fitness, where people had a very hard time resisting highly palatable processed foods when they were just having generic advice or tips, like try to eat healthier or move more. But when they adopt much more aggressive health and fitness philosophies, like maybe they go vegan or paleo or become a CrossFit fanatic, they start to see results. So for some of these very powerful forces, you have to go pretty aggressive in your pushback against them.
Now, how does a person, you mentioned getting rid of optional technologies. How does one decide what's optional?
Well, essentially, you can ask yourself the question, would something bad happen if I stopped using this for a month? So, for example, if your kids use text messaging to tell you they're ready to be picked up from school, you're probably going to get a lot of angry notes from the principal if you stop using text messaging. On the other hand, though, if it's just a mild inconvenience, or even if it's, hey, there's some people I usually stay in touch with, and during this month, I'm not going to be in as close touch with them, even that is probably okay. So unless it's going to cause a serious problem if you step away, I think it's worth putting it on the list of things that you are decluttering.
What should you say to people when you do this, when you suddenly decide to withdraw from your social, online social life?
I mean, you could say nothing at all. Or, you know, you can say, yeah, I'm taking this break. I'm trying to declutter. I'm trying to clean up my social life. You know, something, though, that I've noticed is I've advised people before you tell people, just do it, right? And see, does anyone really notice? Because sometimes these social media platforms have a way of convincing us that we have this rapt audience that really wants to hang on to every word we say, and that they're going to be really upset if they don't get our hot take on what's going on. And so the experiences of noticing that no one cared or no one noticed in your Twitter following when you weren't there for a week can actually in itself be quite instructive, that maybe some of the value you were placing on this was inflated.
Let's take a call, Sandy from Prospect Heights. Hi, Sandy.
Hi.
And what's your comment?
Yeah. I was thinking about a couple years ago when I started a PhD program, I decided to keep aspects of the Jewish Sabbath. And the one that's been the healthiest for me is no computer, no phone, no internet at all, no TV. For 24 hours, which is just something I recommend to anyone who's thinking about sort of taking a detox every week. The other thing I was thinking about is I recently got engaged, and I made the decision not to put it on Facebook, which it was really interesting because everyone's expectation now, it's really that when these life moments happen, they must be shared. It's become sort of part of the whole ritual in a way that I think is really unhealthy, and it kind of takes away a certain level of intimacy or the excitement of telling people in person. So I just wanted to say that that's been really interesting. People kind of, oh, you didn't put on Facebook, so how would I have known?
How does it make you feel at the beginning? How did you feel when you went through this 24-hour period of not engaging online?
Well, I think it is a little bit harder to recommend to people if they don't have a community of people doing it. So the thing about if you're Shabbat observant, especially in a place like New York where there are a lot of Jews, is that you can fill up that whole 24-hour period with community and events and meals that you just don't feel that pull towards the phone. You're enjoying that face-to-face interaction. So I think it would have been a lot harder without that sort of automatic, I don't know, not safety net, but a kind of context to do it in. But I would expect that for people who don't have that, it would definitely be harder, because when you get bored or you get lonely, you get this natural pull towards your phone. So keeping yourself busy and prioritizing face-to-face contact is probably the best way to do it.
Sandy, thanks a lot. Professor, that's an interesting point. If you decide to go through this digital declutter, is it easier? Should you get all your friends on board?
Well, this is a really important point, and it was something that actually surprised me. Last year, I put out a call to my readers to say, hey, does anyone want to do one of these declutter during January 2018? I thought a couple dozen people would say yes. Instead, 1,600 people signed up to do it. And so I ended up learning quite a bit about what works and what doesn't. But something that surprised me from these reports is that it can be really difficult to figure out what to do with yourself when you don't have the screen. In fact, this is actually one of the biggest challenges of decluttering away from these screens, is that they fill a void in our life that needs to be replaced. And so you have to really take seriously, what am I going to do with myself when I don't just have a screen to look at? Having that answer is vitally important, but I don't want to underplay how difficult and how much reflection and experimentation is required to get those answers right.
Let's go to Michael from Sheepshead Bay. Hi, Michael.
Hi, good morning. Well, you know, I similar to Sandy, but I have an answer for the professor. It's called paper, newspapers, and books. Carry a paperback with you on the train. Read a newspaper. It will fill your time in a much more efficient way, and fill your mind in a much more efficient way than looking at a screen which has three sentences of news, okay,
yeah,
and then on to the next subject. Reading a newspaper and reading a book will give you that staying power. But similar to Sandy, I practice a one-day-a-week, 25-hour, I'm not on my computer, internet, cell phone, etc., and I have also enforced that in my business life. So one day a week, no clients, no customers, only family, only friends, face-to-face, and newspapers and books and magazines. And I'll listen to you offline. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's really interesting. I should point out that in your book, Professor, that you do talk about things to do other than be on your phone. And one of them I thought was interesting was build things.
Well, we have this human instinct to see our intentions made concrete in the physical world. I mean, this is the instinct that allowed us to gain a huge advantage as a species, because we can imagine a spear and then actually build a spear. We can see our intention manifested concretely in the world. Because that's so important to our species survival, our brain highly rewards these activities. So there's a reason why actually building something, be it a sweater you knit or something that you carve out of wood, or even a song that you coax out of a real instrument, we get a particularly deep feeling of fulfillment out of that, because it's hard-coded into our species genetics to want to do analog physical things.
My guest is Georgetown professor of computer science, Cal Newport. The name of his book is Digital Minimalism, Choosing a Focused Life in a Noisy World. Vita is calling us from the Lower East Side. Hi, Vita.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. You've thought about this. You've thought about a way to clear up your digital life.
Yes. First thing, a suggestion for everyone, have two emails. One is the junk email, because when you go to CVS, Key Foods, it doesn't matter where you go, they are going to ask you for your email. So you have one for the junk email, which is where all your, you know, unnecessary emails will come in. And one you can have just for your family and friends. So, you know, that's the important one. And then when the junk email comes in, what I do is go to the top, say delete first, all boxes get checked. Then you just see which ones you want to actually look at, uncheck those, delete, and then you'll have the few left that are worth checking out.
Vita, thank you so much. I have to admit, Professor, I do that as well. And part of what you're writing about is making choices and being mindful in the choices you make. And so once you're over this detox, you know, people want to have these apps back on their phone. They want to have certain things in their life. But you write about establishing a, quote, operating procedure to do so. What does that mean?
Well, this is part of the secret sauce that allows digital minimalists to be so much more present and content, is that they never just ask the binary question of what technology I use. They always follow up the affirmative answers with the follow-up questions of how and when I use it. And so, for example, I met quite a few visual artists who told me that Instagram is crucial to their work because they need a steady stream of creative input in order to help them have creative insight. And Instagram has a lot of artwork in progress. But when these artists went through the declutter process, they came out on the other end and said, I don't need Instagram on my phone. I don't need to be checking this 50 to 100 times a day. I can cull down who I follow to 10 artists that I'm really inspired by, and I can look at it Sunday night, and it takes me 20 minutes. And now I'm getting 99% of the real value out of Instagram while sidestepping 99% of the cost. So those operating procedures make a huge difference.
My guest is Georgetown Professor of Computer Science, Cal Newport. We're talking about digital minimalism. We're going to take a quick break, but after the break, we'll talk about the distinction between connection and conversation and have a discussion about reclaiming leisure. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. My guest is Cal Newport, and we're discussing his new book, Digital Minimalism, Choosing a Focused Life in a Noisy World. You talk about the social media paradox. What is it?
Well, there's conflicting research studies out there. You'll find some studies that show when people are using social media, it raises their contentment, especially if they're connecting to family or close friends. It makes them happier. And then you also see these research studies that say the more people use social media, the more likely they are to be unhappy and lonely. So it's almost as if these two studies are in direct contradiction, and that's the paradox right now.
So in trying to resolve this paradox, you distinguish between connection and conversation. Why is this distinction important?
Well, this is one of the big conjectures about what's going on here, is that increased social media use is not making you lonely or unhappy because of what you're doing when you're looking at social media. It's what you're not doing because of this activity. So people are likely to replace more real-world conversation with online interaction. So the more you're using social media, probably the less you're doing real-world analog conversation. However, from our brain's point of view, which has evolved in a milieu where we did not have ASCII characters on a glowing screen, it does not process digital interaction the same way that it processes analog conversation. And so you can think that you're very social because you've been on Snapchat and Instagram and Facebook and text messaging all day long. But a deeper portion of your brain is thinking, I haven't talked to anybody today. I'm really lonely.
So what do you think about the idea of just picking up the phone and calling someone? Is that a better choice than texting at this point?
It is, because the analog component matters. So if I can actually hear the tone of your voice, if we can go back and forth, if we can start participating in limbic consonants where I actually try to match some of the inflection or rhythms of how you're talking, these type of cues are very important and we've evolved to do them. And so phone is much better than text, and in person is even better than phone. The more analog you get, the more happier our social brain is.
I think we've thought of a new hashtag here, hashtag analog matters.
I'm on board with that.
My guest is Georgetown Professor Cal Newport. If you have a question for the professor, the number is 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. So it's interesting. We've been talking about being with people, engaging with people, the idea of lonely. You know, there's a difference between being lonely and being alone. You are a huge advocate for solitude. Why?
Well, it turns out that solitude, and by solitude, I mean time spent free from input from other minds. So nothing to do with physical isolation, but is your mind alone with your own thoughts, or is it processing someone else's thoughts, right? So if you're looking at a screen, if you're listening to something, if you're reading something, you're not in solitude. If it's just you alone with your thoughts, even if you're on the Q train, that's still solitude. solitude turns out to be really, really important. Time alone with your own thoughts is when you process things. It's when you make sense of information you come across. It's where you have insight and self-reflection. It's also a time that allows your brain to do housekeeping and recharging type activities. And if you remove all solitude from your life, it's going to make you unhappy. It's going to make you anxious. It's actually a quite unnatural state for us to exist in.
It is very hard to achieve that these days. To not be near a screen, not be near somebody near a screen, not to have some sort of audio input, visual input. What's a step, an easy step, something that people might not think about as a way to just carve out a little bit of solitude?
Do some things without your phone. This constant companion model of smartphone use, it seems fundamental, but it's incredibly recent, and it required a lot of technological miracles. It's the first time in human history that we can easily banish solitude from our lives. So all you have to do to reverse this is just occasionally do something without your phone. That's enough to get you the type of solitude we used to get just naturally.
It's interesting you say that. I got a dog a year ago, and I've started leaving my headphones at home, taking my phone in case my son needs to reach me, but just walking the dog in quiet, it's really become a time of day I really look forward to.
Well, there's a low background hum of anxiety that our entire culture is feeling right now, and we don't know why, but a big source of that is our brain's not getting any solitude. And so it's a short-circuiting effect, certainly. The brain is, I can't function properly if I don't get that at least 30 minutes alone with the dog, just noticing that, hey, the leaves are coming in on the tree down the street.
On line five, we have Suzala, who is calling us from Long Island. Hi, Suzala.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm an artist. I recently, within the last 3 years, became an urban sketcher, which means that you're sketching the world around you. And I carry a small sketchbook and pen with me wherever I go. And I noticed in the last 3 years that I'm not only looking at my phone less, but when I'm sitting in a doctor's office waiting room or on the train or the subway, then I'm drawing, and I now have pages and pages of books filled with drawings of people looking at their phones.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for calling in, Suzala. You really do believe in the idea of, back to the point of analog, of doing things like writing letters and keeping diaries. What does that do for the brain?
Well, the brain needs time to make sense of itself and its experience of the world. And so doing something as simple as writing, journaling, writing letters to yourself, just trying to make sense of your experience in the written word is very, very useful. And it's something that we did much more naturally in times past. But now that we can fill every minute with algorithmically optimized distraction, it's easy to escape this type of self-reflection and self-organization. And so I really push people, if you get back to that, you find many more layers of depth, meaning, and satisfaction in your life that you might not even realize that you're missing.
My guest is Georgetown professor Cal Newport. The name of his book is Digital Minimalism, Choosing a Focused Life in a Noisy World. We have a question from Lauren. She writes, what about using apps like Fitbit and apps for exercise and activity? Is it worth disconnecting from those?
Not necessarily. I talk about in the book, for example, some people who have switched to a dumb phone, with one exception, fitness apps. And so they'll actually have an iPhone in their cupboard at home that when they go for a run, they take it out because it can do GPS tracking of their route or something like this. And so I don't think that's that bad. To have something that gives you some feedback that can help your athletic performance, that's fine if that's something you really value. It's just about intentionality and using these tools for big gains.
You write a lot about how we spend our leisure time, and my favorite phrase in the book is low-quality leisure. Could you define low-quality leisure?
Well, almost anything you're doing when you casually are looking at your phone is probably low-quality leisure. So it's where you are passively consuming content, probably content that's been algorithmically selected to be highly satiating for your particular statistical data profile. Essentially everything you see on a social media platform, it distracts you. It can touch your emotions. It can be kind of satisfying, like eating a candy bar is satisfying, but it definitely leaves you feeling empty after a while.
I want to go to Jose in Montclair on line 8. Jose wants to defend tech a bit. Hi, Jose.
Hi there. I guess one of the concerns I have in listening to this conversation is the fact that we're not addressing the fact that technology and being able to read your favorite book on a screen or your newspaper on a screen where you can bookmark stuff or highlight stuff in the margins or do all the kinds of things that I would normally do in reading my favorite newspapers, magazines, books. I'm 54 years old. I haven't bought a newspaper in 10 years. I wouldn't even know what it would be like to go to a bookstore. I mean, I go online and I buy the books I want and I am reading stuff and it's on my screen. The other issue that I think is really important are things like messaging apps. Half of my family lives halfway around the world. I'm meeting nieces and nephews for the first time sometimes, in a WhatsApp chat or seeing a sick relative in the hospital and just being able to have a chat with her and tell her that I love her. And to ignore that technology allows us to do that or to somehow shut that off on my phone, I just don't know how I could wrap my head around that.
Jose, thank you so much for calling. What do you think about Jose's argument? He's talking about how tech really helps people stay together, and that's important to acknowledge, and that it also can open up worlds for folks who normally might not go into a bookstore. They might just download a book.
Well, of course, the internet in general, I think, is one of the most important technological innovations since Gutenberg's printing press. But at the core of minimalism is it's not an argument about utility, it's really an argument about autonomy. So to be a minimalist means you actually take the time to figure out what really matters to me, where can I use tech to get big wins, and where am I using tech that's just, let's say, an escape or a diversion or that's keeping me away from more useful things. And so every minimalist has a different profile of technology that they use, but they all use technology in very specific ways and get huge value out of it. But the difference between them and I think most people is that they're very intentional about how they do it. They use the tools that give them big wins in ways that maximize the benefits and minimize the cost, and they're very wary about the tools that don't have a great value proposition for them or that's maybe distracting them more than it's helping. And so, yes, you step away from all this during the digital declutter, but that's just so that you can get clarity on what's important and what's not, so that when you then rebuild your technological life, it's a lot more focused.
It's interesting. People listen to the show know I've written a book about junk and why people collect stuff, physical stuff, why we have so much clutter and junk in the world. And I remember during the research, I spoke to a professor of psychologist who said, you know, people who tend to have clutter in their physical life also have it in their terrestrial, in their internet life and in their digital life. Do you think that's true?
Well, I think there's very strong connections because the mindset is often the same. It's what we call the maximalist mindset, which is if there's any value this thing might bring me, be it, you know, an old birdhouse in my garage or an app that occasionally is useful, I better have that in my life because I don't want to lose that value. And that's the mindset that leads to overstuffed houses as well as overstuffed phones.
How can we learn from social media professionals about minimizing social media use?
Well, they don't use it on their phone. This is the starkest difference I can see between the people who make a living using social media and the way that social media investors make a fortune off of everyone else, is that social media on the phone is entirely about consumer-facing compulsive use. They've engineered these apps to make you want to look at them all the time. People who use social media professionally, let's say on behalf of major brands or on behalf of their company, it's on their desktop. They often have pretty complicated tools that they use that mediates their experience. They have schedules of when they post and how they post. They have advanced methods for doing searches to keep their hands on what's important or what's not. But it's also just very intentional. And so if you're using, let's say, a professional justification for why you're looking at your social media feed 100 times a day, there's probably a little bit of a story that you're telling yourself.
My guest is Georgetown professor of computer science, Cal Newport. The name of his book is Digital Minimalism. What about for people? I know a lot of people I know are in the news and the media business, and basically they have to be connected on their phones. There is some sense of they need to be checking Twitter or various news websites or looking at their alerts. Some of them often feel like they have to respond to emails 24 hours a day. What advice would you give to someone who professionally needs to be tied to these things but doesn't want it to feel so out of control?
Well, journalists have it really bad. This is something I've learned during this book tour, is they're not happy with how much they have to, for example, be on Twitter, or the degree to which their Twitter followers might actually be quantified into their contracts. So it is a problem. I think, for example, the idea that, let's say, journalists need to be following breaking news on Twitter themselves is a gross misallocation of cognitive resources. I think every newsroom in this country, like one of the first things you do if you're an intern in a newsroom is you're in charge of monitoring Twitter, so that the journalist can then be told, hey, by the way, something is breaking, you need to know. But they don't have to fragment their attention the entire day just in case that comes along. And so I think we're going to see more of that in the workplace. Not that we're not going to use these tools, but the idea that everyone has to be on these tools all the time is just not an efficient allocation of these cognitive resources. We can produce more value if we concentrate and systematize how we get information off these platforms and deliver it to the people who need it.
My guest has been Georgetown professor of computer science, Cal Newport. He is the author of Digital Minimalism, Choosing a Focused Life in a Noisy World. Professor Newport, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, a visit with Andy Lancet, WNYC's chief archivist. He's bringing us some very interesting sound from Fannie Lou Hamer. Stay with us.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at zbiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's zbiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.